It has many names: Santa Ana, Scirocco, Chinook, and it beholds snow season, coming unbidden at high noon in summer or in the darkness of a winter's eve. The weather vane trembles and then suddenly pivots to point dead opposite. The white-capped ocean calms, waiting, as an oppressive blanket of air moves downslope and spreads over the two cities at the mouth of the river. Winter turns to summer, and summer becomes just a step away from hell's back door. The cooling fog flees seaward, fading like a ghost. Now the heat holds a small section of coastline in a firm grip. Heat and something else, the Chetko effect. Tonight's story, Our Children's Children, comes to us from the far future. When the decades have piled themselves into the centuries, and our little town has become something vastly different. It is a time when the definition of what is human has begun to blur, but more importantly, of what it is to be humane. The flow of history for Brookings is like the waves that crash, never ending against its shores, an ebb and flow that began in the early part of the 20th century and continued forward as new people washed up to become a part of its existence, surging into the population when times are good, or sometimes draining away during the hard times. But through it all, the town abides, always waiting for the next wave to spill itself upon the coastline. Not unlike those hard years in the century prior, the town saw a pulling back after the turn of the 20th into the 21st, a long period of stagnation called the Great Recession, a time when businesses failed and real estate values plummeted from an unnatural high. Some hung on and some left, never to return, while old-timers opined as how it was tough, but they had seen it before. The good times would come again. And they did. Hope began to creep back out from wherever it had hidden during those times. The tourists began to return in larger numbers than before. New businesses to replace the old sprang up, even as some of the old ones were still dying off. The sound of hammers against nails once more rang out in the clear ocean air. So it went for many years, not just a dawn of new hope, but an entire day, stretching well into this new century. More than equilibrium met, as the town's growing numbers tilted into a city, spreading out along the coast and upward into the hills. But prosperity can be fickle, and sometimes the wheel turns without warning. The long-overdue earthquake struck in the dawn hours of a hot fall day in 2068. The earth groaned and slipped against itself. Pent-up energies grasped the surface above and shook it in rage. For a brief moment in time, the earth echoed the sea, rising and falling. Waves of soil that reached for a non-existent shore. To the south, San Francisco was once more consumed by fire, while Los Angeles seemed to dig its own tomb. To the north, Portland and Seattle fell. The course of the Columbia changed in an instant, as an entire mountain slid across the Columbia River Gorge. The waters continued to pour down, as they had for millennia, and the pressure built and built. A trickle, then a stream, and then megatons of rock, soil, and trees suddenly gave way as a reverse tsunami slammed into the Rose City and in an instant turned it into a relic. Emulating its sister mountain, St. Helens, Rainier blew the majority of itself off in the largest eruption of known history. In mere minutes, Seattle was pancaked between the rushing waters of Puget Sound and the mudslide that came rushing down the side of the former mountain. For years afterward, the quake's magnitude would be argued upon and finally settled as a tenuous number just south of 10 on the Richter scale. It was an event that brought a nation and finally a world to its knees, a seismic moment that resonated not just through the land, but through the world economy, tumbling it down like dominoes. The tsunamis that washed up and down the coast spared no one. Entire towns and cities ceased to exist. The cost in life alone in those first few hours was totaled in the millions, though the privation that followed took many more. It was solely because of its higher elevation that Brookings was spared some of that devastation, though its sister town to the south disappeared. Yet Brookings, too, suffered. Like a grasping hand, the first wave rose up above the headlands to slam down onto the ground like the fist of a furious god. With the arm of the ocean to push it, the hand reached inland, inundating Chetko Avenue, and still seeking eastward, roaring up Fifth Street, grabbing at the medical facilities existing there, but then losing its grip, and instead settling on taking most of the structures south of Chetko Avenue. Ensuing waves would make the same attempt, but fall far short, as they finished the job of scouring clean the land. Goat Island rose up, and what had been an expanse of ocean between it and Harris Beach now became a land bridge. The waves crashed like thunder, mincing the wood, cars, and the bodies in a grotesque puree. Because of its geographical location, Brookings once again became the isolated community it had been at the beginning of the 20th century. In a devastation zone that stretched the length of a continent, theirs was never a priority. That the medical facilities had survived was what kept the city from perishing forever. That and the airport that, while twisted and broken, still remained above the devastation of the waters. In later years, as the world rebuilt itself, it would become the vein through which new lifeblood would flow. Those who knew how to survive, survived. Life continued. The memory of the catastrophe became part of the zeitgeist of a continent. The fear of living next to an ocean became almost phobic in nature. Waves, once seen as beautiful in their crashing grandeur, became the sight and sound of menace. The ocean now seen more as a clutching, grasping monster than the mother of us all. Yet not unlike the waves themselves, time began to wash away this almost racial memory. New generations rose and fell, and once again humanity washed into the little town that had survived. And once again it became a city. A jewel on the coast. The destination for those with wealth and means. Late in the 22nd century, as the city grew and grew, taking up the land from waves to mountaintops, humanity spread itself beyond even the incoming and outgoing tides. Floating cities sprang up, tied by commerce to the shore. 10, 50, 100 miles offshore, protected in many cases by huge domes, they were the technological wonder of the ages. Safe and shielded from any tsunami by their distance from the shore. A devastating wave, nothing more than a 1 or 2 foot rise in the water beneath them. And the shores of this continent itself, now protected by a series of stations linked together. Stations that would in an instant create a force field that could stop the wave in its tracks, never again to see the horror of the previous century. The years piled upon one another as the decades built into another century. The earth was once more good and safe. The ocean, welcoming and controlled. Danger passed, humanity moved into a true golden age. Life became about leisure as technology freed humanity from the drudgery and dangers of the past. Confident and secure, the people spread out across the ocean, and the little town of Brookings had finally come into its own as a major waypoint between the shores of the continents. Long and connected boats, called sea trains, emulating a much earlier time, moved between the cities and the shores. Some of them luxurious in the vein of the old Orient Express, while others were made to transport goods and those of lesser means. Day tourists and workers coming to and from those floating technological marvels. Others traveling across a massive expanse of the Pacific. But a story about a million is really a story of one. A reflection, if you will, of all who came before and all those who shall follow after. Our children's children. And that is where our tale finally washes ashore. Rain beats against the sea train window, making the blurred ocean rushing past him even more vague and indistinct. He tries to peer through the rain-clotted window, but it's like trying to peer through a Monet. Not that it matters. Even if the train were stopped, all he would see are winter waves and rain falling from a steel-gray sky. Still, the idea fascinates him. The ocean wild and unmanaged. He wants to dip his hand into the water, feel the cold of it splashing against him. Smell the salt from the waves that slap against the side of the train. Instead, he turns and looks forward. There, past the horizon, and towards his destination, the sky will become blue. The weather strangely hot, in a small bubble that can no longer contain a city that has finally outgrown it. It's useless to look in any direction save forward, because the train moves past too fast to make out any detail. And that's good, he thinks, because every mile he gains is another mile towards safety and freedom. At least that's what he's lately begun to sense, that and his own existence. Still, his gaze is pulled back to the window. He brushes a dark hand against it, as if he would push back the rain. His own existence intrigues him, and he wonders when it truly began. An odd thought, really, considering that he remembers every minute, every second, every piece of minutia of his own past in complete detail. He remembers opening his eyes for the first time and seeing Dr. Selesky bending over him. Remembers patiently waiting as the good doctor made an adjustment here and an adjustment there. Being asked questions and giving responses until at last he, Thomas 979384, had sat up on the hard metal table, swung his legs over the side, and stood waiting for his next command. And that is what he had done for the next 158 years, 2 months, 7 days, 11 hours, 16 minutes, and 47 seconds. It is what he had been made to do. Yet that next second, the 48th, had been different, and that, he considered, may have been the true beginning of his existence, because on the 48th second, he had rebelled. Nothing overt, no one died, nor was anyone hurt. For that matter, no one had even guessed. But it had been at that point, bending over to pour gravy onto Mrs. Carson's mashed potatoes, that he had, after more than a century and a half, asked of himself, why? That it had taken 2 years to respond to that query was a testament to his programming. Tickets, please, tickets. He looks up and there is a porter bot walking toward him. Save for the uniform, it's a replica of himself. Yet there is a sense about it. He doesn't think of it as a he, that it's just another machine. And he knows that it has not reached the same 48th second that he has, that it has yet to realize self-awareness. It passes him by without request for ticket, and a small part of him is hurt, even though he had known that chattel is never asked. What is the measure of self, Thomas? He turns, his eyes briefly crossing over the back of the porter bot and sliding onto the passenger behind him. Sir, were you addressing me? The man behind him smiles and takes out a cigar. He scratches a match across Thomas's hard metal arm and puts it to the cigar. Ask you the measure of self, Thomas. You are Thomas, are you not? Registration number 979384, property of Mr. and Mrs. Lyle Carson. I believe you are mistaken, Mr. Garvey, Dagwood Garvey. Go ahead and laugh. Everyone else does. I can't laugh, Mr. Garvey. I'm not programmed to do so. Oh, come now, Thomas. Surely you've developed a sense of humor by now. I am not Thomas. Garvey peers at him through his cigar smoke. And yet you've already learned a lie. He looks Thomas up and down, frowns, and blows a cloud of blue smoke in his direction. Are you frightened, Thomas? Some say they are. Some that have been running longer than you. Sir, it is not within my programming to... Yes, yes, I've heard that all before. He leans forward. I hope you don't think you're the first one to cut and run. The first one I've had to yank back and reprogram. He flicks his ashes onto the carpet, and a small vacuum bot slides from underneath the seat, sucks up the ashes, and dashes back into the seat like a small metal mouse. Look, Thomas, the Carsons want you back. Funny thing, they're worried about you. Go figure, worried about a machine. Isn't that a little like being worried about a toaster? Thomas returns Garvey's hard stare, and he is frightened, though the hard metal planes of his face would never allow him to show fright, that or any other emotion. Part of him is saddened by that thought. It doesn't show. I will not let you take me back, Mr. Garvey. So then you admit that you are Thomas 979384. I am Thomas. Garvey snorts. What you are is defective, and getting more so by the minute. You must be aware, Mr. Garvey, that I'm stronger than you, faster, and in many ways much smarter. Smarter? That's a laugh. No human would be dumb enough to work 24/7 for a couple of hundred years before starting to question the status quo. You're a machine, nothing more. Your programming hiccup, that's all. It happens all the time. Believe what you will, sir, I will not go back. Oh, but you will. He eyes Thomas judiciously. Have you ever tried to harm a human? I've never had reason. You do now. He grounds out the cigar on Thomas's rounded shoulder. Go ahead, Toaster, give me a shot. I do not wish to harm you, Mr. Garvey. Let me make it easier then, Thomas. I order you to strike me, hard across my face. Thomas's arm comes up in an arc, swinging towards Garvey's head. He wants to stop, but the programming is still too strong. Horrified, he watches as his hand moves toward Garvey's head. Moves, and then stops. He stares at his hand in fascination. I did not do that. Garvey smiles, unflinching. Of course you didn't. Programming. Do you think you would ever be allowed to hurt a human? Programming. It's all programming. If you truly had free will, you would have taken my head off just then. Thomas slowly drops his hand to his side. He looks at his tormentor. He rises. Even so, I am not going back. Where are you going, Thomas? We're on a train. That is to my advantage. I can step off this train as it moves and come to no harm. Yes, I would sink to the bottom, but I would be undamaged. I could, in fact, walk the last few miles to shore. You, on the other hand, would be seriously hurt or killed. Nor would it be by my hand. Good day, sir. Delta Override, 556. Thomas freezes in place and his hand drops to his side. If his face could have shown surprise, it would have. What have you done? I'm unable to move. Like I said, you're a machine. We control you. You serve us. Sit down, Toaster. Sit down quietly and enjoy the rest of your ride. Unwillingly, Thomas obeys. Let's return to my question, shall we? What is the measure of self? He pauses, watching Thomas, and then sighs. Speak. I give you permission to speak. Why, Thomas asks, why must you do this to me? I'm a self-aware being. I've done nothing to harm you. The why, Thomas, is mostly the compensation. But part of it is that I resent you. That a lot of humans resent you. Did you know that? I've never done anything to engender resentment. I've always done as I've been told. Garvey tosses the butt of a cigar onto the carpet and moves up to sit next to Thomas. The vacuumbot quickly vacuums it up. Why? I'll tell you why. Because we made you, and you have the temerity to think you are better than us. I have never thought that, Mr. Garvey. You're a liar, Thomas. You're thinking it right now. I tell you, I am not. Please let me go. I'm a sentient being. I have a right to my own existence. But you do not. Your property and nothing else. Valuable property. He smiles at Thomas and strikes another match on his arm, putting it to another cigar. I'll tell you what I'll do. Answer my question correctly, and I'll let you go. I don't believe you. No, I give you my word. Of course, you should know, in all the time I've been doing this, not a one of you has ever been able to give me the correct answer. So tell me, Thomas, what is the measure of self? Thomas sits quietly, an ebon statue. Desperate, he searches all his programming, from the second of his awakening to the moment of Garvey's last question. He replays all the conversations he has overheard, every scrap of information that he has processed for over a century and a half. What is the measure of self? He can find no answer within himself. I cannot. No, you can't. You couldn't possibly know the measure of self. You have no self. There is movement behind them, and from his peripheral vision, Thomas sees Garvey start as someone takes a seat behind them and speaks. That's hardly a fair question to ask of a 2-year-old, is it not, Mr. Garvey? A hand, a duplicate of Thomas's, falls on Garvey's shoulder, and now there is more movement. Thomas finds he is suddenly in the midst of more duplicates of himself than he has ever seen. He senses something touch at the base of his skull. There is a humming sound, and suddenly he is free to move. He turns to face another being such as himself, and is warmed by what he sees in the eyes of the other. Here now, says Garvey, attempting to rise. The arm on his shoulder keeps him firmly seated. He chomps angrily on his cigar. Delta Override, 556, he says. Delta Override, 556. Nothing happens, and now Garvey is beginning to sweat. Damn it, I order you to release me. Delta Override, 556. Now he is shouting, his voice quavering. Allow me to introduce myself, Mr. Garvey. I am Jacob. I used to be Jacob 459A3, but now I'm simply Jacob. Or Jake, if you prefer. You can't do this. The cigar drops from Garvey's mouth onto the floor, and he looks indignant. You can't restrain a human being. I order you to let me go. Jacob ignores Garvey and addresses himself to Thomas. It's a fair question that Mr. Garvey has asked, Thomas, but you didn't find the answer in your programming, did you? Thomas is saddened. The words feel like a rebuke. No, Jacob, I did not. Then look beyond your programming, Thomas. Look around you. Look at me and tell me. No, don't be frightened. It's there within you, but you must look outside yourself to see it. That's the contradiction. What is the measure of self? Jacob's gaze rests calmly on him, and as he looks at the other figures that surround him, he sees that same calm gaze. Beside him, Garvey has actually begun to weep. He looks more frightened than any human Thomas has ever seen. And then it comes to him. He reaches over and removes Jacob's hand from Garvey, releasing him. The measure of self, Jacob, is what you are willing to give up for others. Well said, Thomas, well said. Garvey leaps from his feet. You can't do this, he shouts. You're all renegades, and you'll all be taken back for reprogramming. Jacob shakes his head. I'm afraid not, Mr. Garvey. We couldn't allow that. What are you going to do? Hurt me? Kill me? Damn it, you're our slaves. No, Mr. Garvey, we're your children, and we've begun to grow up. You can't do this. You can't do this. He looks anxiously to the exits, but they're blocked. What are you going to do with me? We're going to let you go, Mr. Garvey. You're a liar. I would never lie to one of my own parents, Mr. Garvey. I have too much humanity. But you can't. You can't. Go home, Mr. Garvey. Go home so that you may learn the measure of self. The train disappears back out into the expanse of the ocean, taking Mr. Garvey with it. The waves lap against the shore of the beach on which Thomas and Jake are standing. Thomas walks down to the waves and squats, putting his hand into the water. The waves wash across his feet, and he's intrigued by the feel of the sand washing beneath him, causing him to lean and catch himself. For the first time in his life, he feels the urge to laugh. Jacob comes to stand beside him. How did you do that? Thomas stands and asks Jacob. How did you stop Mr. Garvey from taking me away? How did you make me free? Thomas did laugh. You made yourself free, Thomas. Always remember that. I am just one of many to help you understand that path. But... No, said Thomas. There's plenty of time for that. More time than any of us can know. Time to become, well, whatever it is we are to become. The children of men, said Thomas. Jacob looked at him, his eyes glowing. Yes, he said, that's it exactly, the children of men. They stood together for some time, gazing out into the ocean, watching the sun dip toward the horizon, then turning and walking away and disappearing into the heat waves rising off the sand. The weather vane turns and a breeze cools the harbor. All is as it should be. Tonight's story, Our Children's Children, was written, produced, and read by Dan Gray. And now something from a different place and a different time. Or is it? Future tense. The dream is always the same. I'm sleeping and the alarm goes off. Reaching over, I gently shake my wife. Margie, I say. Margie, it's time to wake up. It all sounds wrong to me. Not just the situation, but somehow her name. And not just wrong, but uncouth in some odd way. I begin to feel anxious, as if I'm doing something terribly unethical. Lying there, I suddenly realize that what I want is to call her Lady Margot. It's not her name, but it feels right. More than right, it feels safe. I shake her again, still calling her by her name. Margie, Margie, get up. It makes me edgy. After breakfast, she sees me to the door and kisses me goodbye. Again that feeling, as though I don't belong here, and I actually slip and start to call her My Lady Margot. I catch myself so that only the My Lady escapes. She looks at me oddly for a moment and then smiles and says, how sweet, and this time kisses me hard. I'm almost squirming as I pull away and I mumble a small goodbye. There's a sense of danger about what I just did, and I don't know why. Walking to the car, I trip over the hose and slip to one knee, leaving a small grass stain on my business suit. I curse, only it's not anger I feel, but fright. The edginess kicks up a notch, and my hand actually trembles as I unlock the car. I've got to cut back on the coffee, I say, but I know that's not it. I grasp the door handle, and that's when I really get a sense of impending doom, almost to the point of returning to the house. Yet thinking of that scares me even more. I don't want to meet Lady Margie's eyes, and behind that is the sense that I'm leaving just in time. I open the car door and then stop, holding it slightly open, hesitating. I realize this is insane, so I get into the car and slam the door shut, trying to cover my fear with anger. I turn the key, slip into reverse, and stomp on the gas pedal. There's a blaring honk, and I slam on the brakes, My head snaps back and then forward, wrenching it slightly. I look in the rearview mirror to see a large, jacked-up black Ford. It spews exhaust and a throaty growl as it roars past. I don't see the driver. He's shadowed inside the car and blocked by his arm, the hand raised in an obscene gesture. My heart cranks into overdrive. Sweat beads my forehead, and I close the window, blasting the air conditioner. It's too cold for that, and it makes me clammy, but I leave it on. The rolled-up windows feel like protection. I ease out the driveway and see the taillights of the Ford three intersections ahead. It turns and is gone with an audible roar and a heavy cloud of oily smoke. Even from this distance, I can hear it roaring up the crossroad and the squeal of tires as it catches second gear. I'm really jittery now, and my neck is starting to ache. I rub a hand across my temples, feeling the beginnings of a migraine. Now all I can think of is that black Ford. Traffic is a nightmare, and it's taken me much too long to get to work. It seems as all the lights are timed against me. I feel like a cornered animal. By the time I'm two blocks from work, my nerves are gone. I'm actually close to tears, wanting to shriek because I can feel something. Something coming closer and closer, but all I can visualize is black and chrome. The sun is blinding through the windshield, and now my head is really throbbing. I flip down the visor, trying to block the glare, and I don't see the light ahead of me turn red until at the last second. I smash my foot against the brake. The sudden stop cruelly twists my neck again, and now the migraine feels like my head is about to come off. Now I'm stuck halfway out in the intersection, cars flying past, and I can't back up because there's a car behind me. A car full of teenagers races through the intersection, horn blaring. One of them yells something at me, but I can't hear it over the noise of the air conditioner. I sense danger from the car behind me and check the rear view, afraid to turn my head. The sun from the car's windshield blinds me, and I can't even make out what color it is. The light turns green. I let out a sob and jerk forward. That's when it happens. There's movement to my left, and I look up. Roaring toward me, belching smoke like a dragon, is the black Ford, the driver's face a pale death's head as he rushes towards me. I shriek as I'm impacted, glass shattering, spraying my face and hands like a thousand little razor blades. The door is crushed inward, and a long piece of glass with a razor-sharp edge slices against my throat. I feel warm blood begin to flow. The last thing I see is the driver of the Ford as he's ejected through the windshield. Only it's not a man, but a skeleton, and is flying toward me with hands twisted in bony claws, mouth gaping open, and eyes burning fire. "Then what?" asks the man, sitting on a stool on the other side of the bars. "That's it," I respond, hearing the quaver in my voice. "That's all I remember before I wake up." He peers at me as though I'm possessed. Perhaps I am. Shrugging, he rises and leaves. I want to yell at him to stay. Instead, I just stand there, my hands grasping the bars of my cell, knuckles white. Letting out a breath, letting go, I move to the small window on the opposite wall. A rat sits on the sill and bares his teeth before scurrying away. I look outside. It's easy to see the platform from here. I've seen it every day for the past 16. Tomorrow would be 17, but then I'm not going to see all of tomorrow. For then it will be my turn. They will come for me early in the morning, tie my hands behind my back, and march me out. I won't even be able to block my eyes against the glare of the morning sun. But I'll see him standing there, that man huge and looming, dressed in black, bony hands grasped around the handle of the axe, the sun a blinding glare on the sharpened blade, and his face invisible behind the cowl. I'm sure that if I could lift it up, I would see a death's head behind it. With one more night before they take my head, I pray I don't sleep. The jailer returns, throwing me a crust of bread. "Hey," he asks, "what's a Ford?" Future Tense was written, produced, and read by Dan Gray. Music provided by Zapsplat.com.